Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. Before we begin, please take a moment to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify. The podcast is distributed on these platforms every Friday and is included in the NAHU's weekly member-exclusive health policy newsletter, The Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died last week at the age of 87, leaving behind a rich legacy that inspired millions of Americans. Ginsburg, nicknamed RBG, was the second woman ever to serve as a justice on the nation's highest court. Ginsburg passing puts the Senate in the position of deciding whether to nominate and confirm another justice before Election Day, less than 40 days away. On this week's episode of the Healthcare Happy Hour, Marcy joins us to discuss RBG's legacy and where we go from here. Marcy, RBG was a legal icon with friends on both sides of the aisle. Can you talk about some of the ways she has impacted the country?
Thanks, Dan. And I think the ways that she impacted the country are more ways than just looking at her voting record on the Supreme Court or some of the cases that she represented before the Supreme Court. I think we all recognize that she made very large strides for the treatment of gender equality in our country. But I think something that you pointed out in your question is really one of the things that are iconic about her. And this is something familiar from when we recorded our podcast, remembering Senator John McCain. He was also known for having friends on both sides of the aisle. And I think with both of these public figures, that's really where we reflect on where we are as a country right now. That's a piece that I think is one of the most important. Being able to respect someone's different opinion than yours and be able to have a civil conversation about it. Oftentimes, of course, when we talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the theme of I dissent comes up, that she was known for her dissent opinions and speaking up when she didn't agree with something. So much so that a children's book I love to buy for my friends is a book about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's life, and it's called I Dissent, and it talks about all of the times, not just as an adult in her professional career, but even just growing up when she said, I dissent. Applying to law school and knowing that they weren't at the time taking any women or that there were very few spots for women in the Harvard class and saying, I dissent and I'm going to apply anyway. And so all of those barriers that came up in her life, saying I dissent, but being able to say it in a way that she was able to maintain those relationships with people that didn't always agree with her. And of course, she has that favorite quote, fight for the things you care about, but do it in a way that will lead others to join you. And I think in those words, you can see a reflection of some of that bipartisanship of fight for the things that you care about, but do it in a way that you can influence others to join you because you're not letting some of those barriers of partisanship come in front of you. And you're able to work together to find a resolution. She was also someone who realized that change, and she would say enduring change, happens one step at a time. And we see that across so many different platforms of issues in America, and realizing that not everything has to be done with a huge upheaval, but getting there one step at a time and doing it together was very important.
Marcy, do you have a favorite RBG story yourself?
Yes. And in the spirit of bipartisanship, I think we all enjoy so many of the stories about Justice Ginsburg and Justice Scalia and all of the things that they did together. There are the stories of them going on their trip and riding elephants together in India and their relationship going to the opera together and eventually being in some of the operas as background actors, never really performing. Although I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg did have a speaking part in an opera here at the Kennedy Center, but doing those things together is always a very heartwarming tale, and the tale of their families, the Ginsburg and Scalia families, spending holidays together. But personally, one of my favorite Ruth Bader Ginsburg experiences was that I actually saw her in person in 2014 at the opening of La Boheme at the Kennedy Center. And I was there with a very dear friend of mine. It was intermission, and the friend I was with had box seats, which was very fancy for us. And so we went over to the special area for intermission that came along with those seats. And we are just chatting away about our experience at the opera. And we look over and we see Ruth Bader Ginsburg standing there holding court, pun intended, just entertaining the friends and colleagues around her and wearing her lace gloves like she always does. And it was just a monumental experience just to see her in her kind of natural habitat, enjoying the opera, enjoying those around her, and just really being one of those figures in DC that when you see them, you know that you've become a Washingtonian.
What were some of RBG's landmark cases?
Some of the landmark cases for when she was actually on the bench, and of course, she was sworn in 1993. And has spent 27 years on the bench, which makes her the longest serving female on the Supreme Court. Of course, she was the second sworn in, as you mentioned in the intro, after Justice O'Connor, who was sworn in 1981 and retired in 2006. So she had 25 years on the bench. And I've actually met Justice O'Connor in person and actually had a conversation with her. So that was quite monumental for me as well. And Justice O'Connor, as the first woman on the Supreme Court being sworn in the year that I was born. And then I actually went to the law school that was the first law school ever to grant degrees to women. So being able to meet and chat with her was an amazing experience. But now we have Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who exceeded Justice O'Connor's tenure by 2 years, serving 27 years since 1993. And in 1996 was one of the biggest decisions for her. The United States versus Virginia, which was decided in 1996, regarded the Virginia Military Institution's male-only admissions policy. And the challenge was that it was in violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment.
Pardon the interruption, folks. We'll return to the podcast in just a few seconds. We are sure you have seen our weekly COVID-19 email updates, but did you know that we also have a relief fund to help NHU members? This fund allows members to apply for monetary assistance or donate to help fellow members in need. Just go to nahu.org and click the COVID-19 Relief Fund button right on the homepage. Thanks for your time, and enjoy the rest of this week's episode of the Healthcare Happy Hour.
Now, again, I know I keep reflecting back onto my own experiences, but at this time, I was in high school in South Carolina, and the South Carolina Military Academy, the Citadel, was actually going through similar challenges. So it was fascinating to watch this in real time being played out in the Supreme Court level. The Virginia Military Institution suggested that a parallel program for women be allowed, and that that would be kind of a separate but equal program that would be held at Mary Baldwin College. Ruth Bader Ginsburg felt that this compromise was insufficient and would not provide women with the same education, training, or post-graduation benefits as the men, and the court ended up voting 7-1 in favor of the United States. And this created a very important precedent for future sex discrimination cases. And even though this was decided by an 8-panel bench at the time, there was a vacancy. It was 7-1. It wasn't something that was a 5-4 decision or a decision that was made by the difference of one vote here. But allowing for 7 justices to vote in favor against VMI was huge when we look at the impact that it had on similar colleges and institutions that were taking public funds and yet not providing equal access for both genders. She also had some dissenting opinions that are worthy of note. Leadbetter versus Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company from 2007 is another one. This was a different challenge on the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This was where Lily Ledbetter sued her employer when she found out she was getting paid less than her male colleagues. And this decision actually went in favor of Goodyear. And they pointed out that Ledbetter didn't respond within the required 180 days. She was almost 2 decades late on that. And Ginsburg dissented and she wrote, "The court's insistence on immediate contest overlooks common characteristics of pay discrimination. Pay disparities often occur, as they did in Ledbetter's case, in small increments. Pause to suspect that discrimination is at work develops over time. Comparative pay information, moreover, is often hidden from the employee's view."
Meaning that it often takes more than those 180 days to realize that some of these inequalities are happening. And even though she was dissenting opinion in this case in 2007, this was a 5-4 decision. Years later, just 2 years later in 2009, President Obama took office and he signed into law the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which prohibits sex-based wage discrimination. So her dissent and the wording of that did cause Congress to take action and realize that when reading the letter of the law, if the Supreme Court can rule in favor of Goodyear in this case, then the law needs to be revisited. And that's exactly what Congress did. And President Obama was able to sign that into law. And then finally, I think when we look at what she has done for equality in our country, you have to mention Obergefell versus Hodges, the 2015 Supreme Court case, where she was actually able to use some of those previous decisions, like the 1996 United States versus Virginia opinion that I mentioned earlier for VMI. She was able to use those opinions to prove that the government cannot treat men and women differently based on their gender. I think most of us remember this case. But this is the case that determined that when same-sex couples sued their states for their bans on same-sex marriage, it was argued that discriminating against gay men and women was a form of sex discrimination. And because of the precedence of Justice Ginsburg, throughout her years on the bench and her history as an advocate for the LGBTQI community, the Supreme Court sided with Obergefell and cited 5-4 guaranteeing same-sex couples the right to marry. And this has led to the extension of rights and coverage for same-sex marriages and for folks in the LGBTQI community for several different platforms for not just employment and marriage, but also benefits under employment and other pieces that we've talked about just as recently as last week with the Compliance Corner with the Bostock ruling. Again, a Supreme Court decision in which she was with the majority opinion there in protecting rights under Title VII. So we can see here that there is a longstanding approach to protecting equality. And then lastly, and this goes back to 2002, there was a case that revolved around providing medical services for employee welfare benefit plans covered by ERISA that denied someone's request to have surgery on the ground that the procedure was not medically necessary. This was something that was based on states having the authority to protect patients' rights. And she did rule on the deciding factor that states had that authority, not the federal government. And so when we look back to all of the pieces, when we talk about states being able to oversee what's happening within their borders when it comes to healthcare, this was one of the legal decisions that helps to really hold that up. And this was the Rush Prudential HMO versus Moran case of 2002. And this really helps us when we're talking about some of the pieces of the ACA that we'll get to later, talking about those states' rights when it comes to health insurance and being able to oversee their own markets for states. This case really helps that. And this is one in which Ginsburg was along with the majority opinion on this and has really upheld this.
As of now, do you expect the Senate will move to nominate another Supreme Court nominee prior to Election Day?
As of now, I would be very skeptical of that. And this is really, and I'm going to take a lot of the politics out of it. We can talk about the politics in a few minutes. But when we just look at the calendar, when we just look at the facts, the average time to go through the nomination process is about 70 days. And right now, we're 40 days away from the election. So if the Senate and President Trump were to act to nominate and approve a nominee, it would happen in record-breaking time by far. And with the weight that a seat on the Supreme Court holds, doing something in warp speed oftentimes can make people think that it hasn't been done with enough reflection and thought needed to take such an important vote. So I don't think that we will have one prior to Election Day. Having said that, there is a possibility that we could see a nomination go to the floor after Election Day, but before Inauguration Day. And remember, Inauguration Day is January 20th.
with that, the decision could definitely be influenced by the election, and not just the presidential election, but when we see, or hopefully potentially see, hopefully there's not too much lag time after election day and when we get the results for all of the different seats that are up for election. But once we see what the potential breakdown will be for the next Congress, specifically the next Senate, that could impact whether we see swift movement here. It will also impact the criticism of swift movement, but the possibility, when we just are looking at the process that this takes, the possibility of having someone nominated and approved in 40 days is just unlikely when we look at the process that this takes. And also taking into consideration that right now, the Senate has less than 10 days that they're scheduled as voting days. And so they would have to rework their entire Senate floor schedule. Many of them, 35 senators, are up for re-election this year. So enough that they would have to alter their campaign schedules over the next 40 days. So there are a lot of different moving parts to getting a nomination through that, when we look at time alone, makes it less likely.
If Republicans choose to move forward to nominate another Supreme Court justice before Election Day, how many votes do they need to approve the president's nominee?
In order to approve a Supreme Court nominee, the Senate needs 51 votes, so a simple majority. Typically, to get a bill through the Senate, they would need 60 votes. There's another process called reconciliation, where if everything in a bill relates back to the budget, it could possibly be passed with a simple majority. But typically, bills are passed with a 60 votes. And Supreme Court nominees go to that simple majority rule, so they are approved with 51 votes. Currently, the Senate has 53 Republicans and 47 Democrats. So the Democrats would need four Republicans to vote along with them in order to vote down any Supreme Court nominee. And remember, like I mentioned earlier, there are 35 seats up for re-election. 12 are Democratic, and 23 of those Senate seats are Republican. So they are going to be very careful with their vote on this as to whether it could impact their reelection for their Senate seat for those 23 Republican senators. So far, we have only heard from two senators on the Republican side, Senator Collins and Senator Murkowski, that have stated that they would not be in favor of moving forward with a Supreme Court replacement at this time, going back to what is referred to as the Thurmond rule, that says if there is a vacancy in the Supreme Court during a presidential campaign year, the vacancy should wait until the election has concluded and the next president should be the president to make that nomination. And as a reminder, Justice Ginsburg's close friend, Justice Scalia, passed in early 2016, which we all know was an election year. And even though he passed in March of 2016, 9 months before the election, the Republicans in the Senate and the majority at that time held strong that they needed to wait until the next president was elected, until after Obama had finished his term almost a year later, to vote on that replacement. And so here we are with Scalia's friend from the other side of the aisle passing in a presidential election year with the tables turned, where we're sitting in a Republican presidency and going into an election year. As I mentioned, we had two Republican senators who have said that they would not be comfortable moving forward, Senator Collins and Senator Murkowski, but the Democrats would need two more to vote with them in order to vote any nominee down. We have already heard from some moderate Republicans like Romney that that is not something that they are considering at this time, but I think it could also really depend on who the nominee is. And we've had some names that have been shared with the media, but we don't know who that will be or could be going to the Senate floor.
Hey, you. Yeah, you listening right now. Did you know that NAHU has an election special on our single-payer certification course? Take advantage today with 20% off with the code TOGETHER until November 3rd. The structure of our healthcare system is a top campaign issue in our upcoming election. Although NAHU, of course, is opposed to any single-payer system, it is our priority to provide you with information, tools, and resources to keep you informed and competitive. Until November 3rd, take advantage of 20% off an AHU single-payer healthcare certification course with the code TOGETHER. Again, the code is TOGETHER for 20% off until Election Day. Now enjoy the rest of this week's episode of the Healthcare Happy Hour. So, how do you think this will impact the election overall?
I think that the biggest way that this could impact the election is just turnout. There are some issues that some people feel very strongly about. And for some voters, it's the Supreme Court and knowing who is going to be filling that seat. And that goes for both sides of the aisle. So we could see some people who may not have been energized by this election or by some of the issues that the candidates are talking about, but just feel that for the longevity of their political opinion, that they want to make sure that they know the next seat will be filled by either a Republican or Democrat and will vote along those lines. And for a large group, this is something that impacts their turnout. And I think that is probably the biggest way it could impact the election is just turnout. I don't think that this is going to cause anyone to really change their vote, but it could cause people to vote.
Now for the major question, what implication does all of this have for Texas v. U.S., the case challenging the ACA that the Supreme Court is scheduled to take up in November?
This could have a lot of implications on Texas v. U.S. And just going back to one of the earlier questions you had about replacing this seat and looking at the timeline that they're under, the likelihood of this vacancy being filled by November 10th, which is when this case is scheduled to be heard before the Supreme Court, again, that's just a week after the election. So when we look at time frame alone, the likelihood of getting anyone nominated and through the approval process is very slim. So the possibility is that we are going to see this case heard by a bench of eight. When we look back at Justice Ginsburg and where she has cited on previous ACA cases, which I purposely left out of those landmark cases that I mentioned earlier, and we look at the Burwell case and we look at NFIB, and Justice Ginsburg has repeatedly voted in favor of upholding the ACA and even dissenting on some pieces of the majority decisions where she felt like they didn't go far enough. And so here, I think many people assumed that she would also vote in favor of upholding the ACA when it came to Texas v. U.S. And so now we have that vote off the table. Looking at that, what many thought would probably be a 5-4 decision, possibly a 6-3 decision. Now we're looking at this where it could be a 4-4 decision splitting the Supreme Court, which I think would lead to further cases down the line, remanding, sending things back to the lower courts, and extending this process of litigation over the ACA. There's still a chance that that could happen, even if we do have a majority opinion coming out from Texas v. U.S. Again, we're not expecting this until June 2021, but a new justice wouldn't be able to provide an opinion on a case that they didn't sit in on. So this would still be based on the justices that heard this case in November of 2020. So there is some thought that Justices Kavanaugh and Roberts have ruled in favor in the past on severability, which is a question in this case, whether the individual mandate can be severed, can it be taken apart from the ACA and let the rest of the ACA stand? And severability in general, just that idea of taking the bad piece out of the law and keeping the rest, whether that's okay. And Justices Kavanaugh and Roberts have said that's okay in other cases, but we don't have their track record when it comes to something that's as specific as this. And of course, Roberts has been a swing vote in the past on healthcare issues, and Kavanaugh now is new and haven't had the opportunity to hear from him on some of these ACA challenges. So there are a lot of questions here. Other than the possibilities of the Supreme Court ruling to remand this and send it back to the lower courts just to be able to extend that time period, I think there are also thoughts that this increases the possibility of the Supreme Court possibly ruling with a little bit more legal gymnastics to attempt to make pieces work and be a little bit more moderate. Although this court has said several times over the past several years that they do want to make sure that they're interpreting the law and not changing the law or going back and revising what Congress did wrong, but that they're truly interpreting the letter of the law. And so I think that's another piece to keep in mind. Although just from the standpoint of what is best for the market, the health insurance market, how much upheaval would happen if the ACA was determined to be unconstitutional? They're not supposed to be thinking about that. They're just supposed to be thinking about the letter of the law, but it's hard for them not to. And so knowing that if they remand some of these things, that they send certain questions back to the lower court, or knowing that if they stay certain pieces, which means let them remain pieces of law while other pieces are being litigated, knowing that it provides them time to then get to a bench of nine and have that broader perspective, regardless of which president is nominating that seat at that point, that has to be in the back of their minds when they're trying to make these decisions. So the possibility of having a more moderate or generalized opinion, which will lead to further litigation, I think increases with this as well.
It is now time for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour Toast of the Week. What are we toasting to this week?
This week, although we have dedicated our podcast to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, we're also dedicating our toast to her for upholding those rights that so many of us enjoy to this day. She will now become the first woman to lie in state at the Capitol. Rosa Parks was also given the privilege to lie in honor in the Capitol in 2005, but Ruth Bader Ginsburg will be the first woman to lie in state in the Capitol, which is a privilege that has only been extended to former presidents and members of Congress after their passing, and only 32 others have laid in state in the Capitol. She will also lie in repose prior to that at the Supreme Court. And President Taft was the only other Supreme Court justice to do both. But of course, he was also a former president. And so he was able to both lie in repose at the Supreme Court and lie in state in the Capitol, which are the plans to honor Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts or to become a member, visit NAHU.org.